B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back once again, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy. Back from a long weekend last weekend playing tournament golf down at Myrtle Beach. While down there, shot some footage for a video project highlighting the TPC at Myrtle Beach. That'll be up soon. And I got to tell you, TPC Myrtle Beach in some kind of unbelievably Augusta-like condition. Also, you'd be hard-pressed to beat the condition at Myrtle Beach National, the King's North course. Believe it or not, kids, green grass is just 3 hours south of here. Meanwhile, on the PGA Tour, Dustin Johnson entered some rare air last week with his win at the WGC event in Mexico. He's now won 20 times on tour. That's a magic number. It means he's got a lifetime exemption. It means if he doesn't make a dime 1 year, his card and playing privileges are secure. We'll talk about where DJ now stands in the history of things with Ron Green Jr. at the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Also, we'll check in with Andrew Sapp, the head men's golf coach at East Carolina, about his Pirate squad at midseason, where they've been, how they've done, and where they're going. And we'll wrap things up with a fascinating conversation today with Michelle Holmes. She's a master kids instructor. I'd never heard of that. Out of Chesapeake, Virginia. If you've got kids in the game or kids wanting to get in the game, you will want to pay attention to what Michelle has to say. But first up, Ron Green Jr. Let's start with something you wrote about in Global Golf Post Plus. I'll never be able to say that.
GPP Plus. It's easier.
GPP Plus. And that's about Dustin Johnson with his win last week in Mexico. This is 20 wins. This is the magic number. This is lifetime exemption. You don't have to worry about your card for the rest of your life on the PGA Tour. And to me, gosh, I guess he's almost been so regular and so consistent that we don't pay attention to it. He's got more wins than a lot of players who are in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, and it's obviously just a matter of time before he goes into the Hall of Fame. But, yeah, it just struck me that if you could do what he's done quietly, he seems to have done it. I mean, for the longest time, when we would talk about Dustin Johnson, it seemed like we were talking about, you know, the U.S. Open he didn't win or the shot he hit out of bounds at St. George's with the Open Championship, what happened at Whistling Straits. We marvel at his swing and sort of how closed he has at the top and the way he plays and, you know, his Instagram accounts and all those things. But, I mean, he's a tremendous player. I mean, I think he's been number one, I think, 81 weeks, which is like fifth longest or something, and he'll ascend to number one next week. And, boy, when he gets it going and finds what little tweak he needs, as he was talking about last week, when he starts playing like he did in Mexico, look out, because, I mean, he makes it look so easy.
Well, he made the comment that really took me to go, whoa, was he felt like he was playing as good as he was 2 years ago before the Masters. And I think it was almost a fait accompli if he doesn't fall down those stairs on Tuesday or Wednesday at Augusta. There was no one who was going to beat him that week. He was playing that well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think now, obviously, there's a Players' Championship coming up first, but Augusta's, you know, starting to be close enough that you can sort of see it in the distance. And yeah, you can ask the guys in Vegas. They immediately put him back at the top of the list of favorites, and for good reason. I mean, you're trying to build a guy who could play Augusta with his length. I mean, that gives him such an advantage anywhere, but particularly at Augusta. And his wedge play, the way he controls distances, which was so good in Mexico, where you've got to deal with the altitude and all those things. And, you know, he can hit it as well as you want to, but unless you can make some putts, it doesn't be as much good as it could. And now he's putting it. You know, he goes back and forth once in a while between putters. But, I mean, he just stands over it, and you get that feeling it's going to go in. And you can tell that he expects it to go in. So, I mean, you know, I think he's got two more starts between now and Augusta, the match play and then the Players' Championship. And he is I mean, he will be right at the top of the list when people start picking their favorites.
You know, and when you look, I like to judge golfers by not just winning tournaments, but where those tournaments were played. I like to look at the golf courses. That's why I always respect, even though Justin Rose doesn't have as many wins as some people, you look at the big boy courses that Justin Rose has won on, and you have to take notice. And the same is true of Dustin Johnson. You have them listed. Pebble Beach, Doral, Firestone, Oakmont, Riviera. He's not winning, you know, at some Muni somewhere.
No, and winning at Club de Golf Chapultepec down there in Mexico City, which played whatever, 7,200 yards, was effectively 6,300 yards, tight with trees and all of that, forcing you to, you know, dictating where you go. He showed he could gear it down, that he could play what is effectively a shorter golf course and still win. So he can do it in different ways. I mean, when you put him on a big place like an Oakmont, I mean, that's just perfectly suited for him. But he, now that he's got the sponsorship deal and he will be playing at Hilton Head, everybody thought last year was a terrible fit for him playing Harbortown. But it wouldn't shock me if he goes to Harbortown this year, having been through it once last year, knowing what he wants to do, that, I mean, he could win there too.
No, wouldn't surprise me at all. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. One more thing about, or a couple more things about Mexico. Bryson DeChambeau, and we bring up the how great Dustin was able, and this wasn't his first rodeo down in Mexico. He, you know, he's able to handle the altitude and figure out the differences in clubs. And as I watched Bryson play, at least through the first three rounds, I didn't see much of his Sunday round. He just seemed to be, you know, God love him, for all the credit he gets for being such this analytical thinker, it just seemed to me he couldn't get out of his own way in Mexico, and he was the one guy that I saw who just didn't seem to be able to figure it out.
Well, as analytical as he is, I sometimes wonder when it gets going sideways, whether it was there with altitude and all that, or just, you know, the natural ebb and flow of the game, because it happens to everybody. If, you know, then suddenly all these things that sort of become easy and second nature to you when you're playing well and it's going good, does that just become static in your head while you're trying to sort through it? And, you know, maybe there's some of that. And, you know, he's still young and gets frustrated when he doesn't play well. And, you know, then maybe sometimes you try to force issues and, you know, you can do all the equations you want to, but sometimes it just doesn't happen. And it was an unfortunate moment when he got caught in the background slamming his putter into the green, practice green there. That was for a guy who just come up banging the edge of a bunker. But it just speaks to the frustration sometimes. And, you know, I think I going forward, and, you know, I check it off as 1 week. I mean, he's going to be just fine.
You bring up an interesting point about Ricky Fowler. And this was a weird controversy with the new rules that happened in Mexico. Ricky hit a pure shank and had to take a drop.
Is there any other kind?
A pure? No, there's not. There's a pure shank, and then there's the, well, it was just a little shank. The pure shank is the one.
Like being a little pregnant?
Yeah, a little. Exactly. But anyway, so Ricky has to take the drop. And I got to think that a shank when you're a pro is just absolutely, you know, mind-boggling, and you're in complete shock. And as such, Ricky, out of habit, held his arm straight out and dropped the ball and then played the shot, which at that point, you're penalized. You write, and I'm in agreement with you. Look, if you drop it from shoulder length instead of knee length, why is that a penalty? That's stupid. But do you still have a problem with just the knee length drop, or is it something we need to get rid of and go back to the arm length?
I guess the reasoning behind this is if you're dropping it from knee height versus shoulder height, there's less chance of the ball rolling out of the
right
designated drop zone. That's what this was about. I think it's led to some sort of silly contortions and everything. I know that's about a pace of play issue, and we're all for speeding up the game, but I think that's such a minimal thing there that happens so frequently. I think anywhere from knee height to shoulder height should be fine. I'd be interested to see if they're going to revisit that. Talking to our publisher who spent last weekend at the USGA meeting in San Antonio, they were pretty resolute that they like the way the rules have come together and where they're going with them. Although it's interesting to see Martin Slumbers, the head of the RNA, say something pretty contrary, saying the new rules have not gone as smoothly as we would have hoped. And I saw he also commented that he'd never considered leaving the flag stick in, thought it was a nice aiming device and helped in a lot of ways speed up play, but never thought of it as being able to use it as an advantage, which obviously some guys feel they're doing, which gives me the glimmer of an idea that maybe they will revisit that at some point. But I wish they would change the drop rule back to the way it was, just anywhere in there. But I'm not optimistic that's going to happen anytime soon.
I know you're not surprised that the USGA doubled down on their decisions this early into it, saying it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. That doesn't surprise you at all, right?
I think they are very resolute in making it's easy when you have change, and they've said it themselves. We're all sort of resistant to change, and things go from what you're so accustomed to and so comfortable with to something different, and you have some little hiccups there, and so it gets a little bumpy there for a while. And I think they're trying to take the long-term view that just let this settle in. We're just getting to March. Give us some time, and it'll all work its way out. Yeah, and maybe so. People keep talking about the PGA Tour. Maybe they should set their own rules, do all this. The PGA Tour was involved in this rules thing for the 6 or 7 years they went through it. I mean, have seated at the table. I talked to people who were involved in writing and setting these new rules, tour officials who were all on board with this. But I think when you get – so I don't think the tour necessarily needs its own set of rules. But I think when you go from putting it on the paper to putting it in practice, there's been a few bumpy areas right now.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Speaking of rules, let's talk a little bit about the concept of backstopping. This came into play on the LPGA Tour big time last week, and it's come into play a couple of times on the PGA Tour, but not to this extent. The incident with Amy Olsen and Aria Jitanagarn, I can't believe that neither one of them was penalized. To me, I saw the replays. I saw the nods. This was blatant, don't you think?
Well, when you just look at the video, it certainly looked like they knew what was happening there. But they, gave impassioned defenses of themselves. What I'm saying, she didn't even know what backstopping was, which I find a little hard to believe.
Yeah, please.
I go back to what my buddy John Huggan in Scotland would say and others. If you were playing a match against that person, would you leave your ball down? No, you'd go mark it. I think it's an issue that's continuing to draw attention. This obviously sort of focused it for a moment. And I think Carl Paulson on the radio the other day said, I think you solve it easily. If it looks like a potential backstopping situation, one stroke for the person who's hitting the shot and two strokes for the person who didn't mark their ball. Just stop it.
That's all it would take. And this is also my issue with slow play. Anytime J.B. Holmes gets in contention, this comes out. But you know what? If you really want to stop slow play, it's already in the rules, just like this backstopping. It's already in the rules. Just penalize somebody and cost them strokes, i.e. dollars, and that will solve it quick.
Well, now the PGA Tour will tell you it is not actually in the rules, that the 40-second clock is not part of their pace of play guidelines. If you have not been officially warned to put on the clock, they do not use the 40-second clock. They give players time to hit shots. I would say that one way to solve it is, all right, boys, here's the first tee. Clock starts now. Everybody's on it. Let's go. I think that's what it's going to take. I don't foresee that ever happening. I think it happens when we get a situation like happened with J.B. Holmes in Los Angeles, and it really boils over and it's so awful, so frustrating. And even a tour official who was running the thing out there said by the time they got to the 18th hole, it was a disaster. Although the group in front of them had in fact been warned about slow play because they were holding J.B. up briefly on the back nine there. So I don't think the players, they talk about it, but I don't think they're willing to do much about it. I think the pack is more concerned with other things. And, until a sponsor comes to them and says, listen, fellas, we're losing people because you're taking so long to play that we're going from CBS to the Golf Channel or whatever. We're going to do something. That's where it's going to have to take root, I think. I can't tell you the number of emails I got this week after my slow play column. People talking about, I don't watch the golf live anymore. I tape it so I can buzz through the commercials and all the waiting I have to do while guys are lining up shots. You know, I don't know that there's a groundswell. I think it's a wave that comes and goes. But I think if the more conversation, the better, because there's no question we're in a time where the window of viewing or watching or participating is shrinking. And, you know, whether it's NASCAR, whose races are too long, or, you know, look at Major League Baseball. They may actually implement the 20-second pitch clock this year. I think if you're not paying attention to it, not thinking about it, you're making a mistake.
Well, it just seems to me, if nothing else, and you know, I kind of wince when I hear J.B. Holmes say, you're not playing for $1 million. I don't care what you say. I'm going to play at my own pace. I just think that's kind of arrogant and stupid. But I remember at Torrey Pines a year ago, Jason Day looked like he wanted to kill J.B. Holmes. And I dang sure got the idea that both Adam Scott and Justin Thomas were ready to wring his neck on that back nine because and you've pointed this out before too, the only person who doesn't care about slow play is the person who's playing slow. And so at that point, does it not become a competitive edge for you to be the slow player if nothing is ever said or done?
Yeah, slow players never have to wait, so it seems. But, yeah, I think when you go back to Jason Day waiting out there at Torrey Pines, well, it actually affected Alex Noren, who was waiting to hit a shot to potentially get into a playoff. And he had to wait 4 minutes for J.B. Holmes to decide what he was going to do. And knowing if he hit the green, then two would have a putt for an eagle, could get into a playoff. But J.B. took 4 minutes and then decided to lay up, which just added to the aggravation. But I don't know. It's, I think people know who the slow players are, but pushing it to the point where something gets done about it, I mean, you know, they did it in the match play or the team event in New Orleans 2 years ago to two players basically nobody had ever heard of. And then they got the young kid at the Masters a few years ago. But if they started doing it more often, it might produce some results.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. My eyeball test still tells me when Rory McIlroy is playing his best golf, he makes it look easier than anyone in the business. Rory McIlroy is 56 under par in four starts this year and hasn't even sniffed the winner's circle. Is he frustrated, or do you think he's just saying, okay, this is great, I'm getting closer and closer and closer?
I think probably some of both. I mean, he wants to win. He knows what people are saying, and he's had some chances in some final groups and all that stuff. I mean, nobody was really probably going to realistically beat Dustin Johnson down there last weekend. But, I mean, as you hear golfers say and other people say, if you just keep giving yourself chances, you know, sometimes you don't have to go win a golf tournament. But if you're in the right position, the golf tournament will come to you. That's not typically how Rory wins, is he goes out and grabs them. But you take them any way you get them. But I think, we all know he's got that career Grand Slam hanging over him as he goes to Augusta. I think if he can keep doing what he's doing, I mean, sometimes you look at him and he doesn't putt as well as you hope he might, but, I mean, you don't play those first four turns once he got two T4s, a T5, and a second. I mean, he is right there, and just so happened last week that Dustin Johnson played better than him, and sometimes you just got to say, tip your hand and say, okay, my best wasn't good enough this week.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And when we return, head men's golf coach Andrew Sapp takes dead aim at his East Carolina Pirates squad, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Andrew Sapp is the head men's golf coach at East Carolina, and we had the chance to get caught up this week. Coach, before we talk about your team or results, I want to talk about something that happened between the last time we spoke and now, and that's a little something we like to call Hurricane Michael that literally came right up your back door. How did it affect your team? How did it affect the places you play and practice? What sort of impact did Michael have?
Well, we were fortunate. It really didn't hit Greenville as hard as it did just 20 miles from here. The only person that it affected tremendously was Blake Taylor, who lives outside of Wilmington, and he went home before the hurricane, and he couldn't get back.
So I'm laughing. That's horrible, but gosh.
Yeah, it took him a while to be able to get back, but we were fortunate. I mean, it didn't really have any effect on our golf courses or practice facilities, and our campus suffered no damage, unlike so many other campuses like UNC Wilmington, who suffered tremendous amount of damage, and those poor players and college students missed a lot of class throughout that time frame. But here in Greenville at ECU, we were just got a lot of rain.
How many students outside the golf team and Blake, how many students were affected? Because I know that I have a friend who lives in Greenville who was actually up here staying with me. And when he finally tried to go back home, it took him about 10 or 12 hours taking back roads and zigging and zagging to get home. How many students were affected just by trying to get back to ECU?
Quite a few. I mean, I think that was the main reason for even us delaying school reopening, because so many people had gone home for safety, as the university told them to do, and then couldn't get back. So obviously at East Carolina, a lot of the students are from the eastern part of the state and were widely affected by the hurricane.
Coach Andrew Sapp is the head men's golf coach at East Carolina. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, let's talk golf now. Enough weather. You and I neither one are qualified to talk about weather.
Sure.
Let's talk about the fall and how you felt you did. Looking at the results, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 top tens, and, well, I guess 7 top tens. You include the 10th at the Rod Meyers. Is that about where you thought your team would be, or was it a little bit better or a little bit worse than you expected?
I have high expectations, so I'd probably say a little bit worse.
I don't think any coach has ever said, you know what, it was right where I wanted to be, or it was better. No, there's no coach that ever answers that.
Exactly. But we had a lot of great things happen in the fall. Blake Taylor had finished the fall with 3 straight top 3 finishes. We had a lot of different individuals have their career low individual round and or career low finish. But we're young. So the fall, we kind of have gone through some bumps and bruises of trying to become more and more consistent, but without any seniors on this team. And it's definitely been a challenge, but it's been nice to see one freshman get in the starting lineup every event in A.J. Beachler. And he's had a top 10 finish already this spring. So we're growing and we're getting there, and we've got a lot of golf left to play.
Let's talk about AJ for a second before we get to Blake Taylor. You and I have talked many times. One of our favorite things to watch is the development of freshmen their first year at college, because there's so much that they have to get used to just as living on their own and being on their own for the most part for the first time outside of being a Division I college athlete and all the expectations that are placed on them with that. So some guys just develop faster than others, and apparently AJ got used to the system pretty quick.
He has. I mean, obviously, from a golf standpoint, he came in with a lot of confidence and a lot of talent, having won 2 North Carolina State High School championships and being on state team championships. So he came with the golf pedigree and the understanding of what to do from a golf standpoint. And so, yeah, it's always wondering how well and how quickly they're going to adjust to life away from home, as well as, you know, the rigors of college academics. And he's done a fine job balancing those things out for us so far, and we'll just continue to grow. I mean, he's had his bumps along the way, but he's kind of smoothing those out this semester, which is good to see.
last year, last summer specifically, had a chance to talk with Blake Taylor. He qualified for the PGA event at the Greenbrier and damn near made the cut. And you and I talked in the fall about perhaps a confidence carryover from that success bleeding into the fall at ECU. And apparently it really has. This is a special player that's doing great things for your program right now.
For sure. I mean, Blake's averaging under 72 so far for the entire season. Had a great fall. And we're looking forward to seeing what he can continue to do this spring. He's one of the highest ranked players in our conference right now, in the American Conference. And he's just a fantastic player and has a lot of confidence based on what he's done over the summer. And I've always told people, whether it's recruits or whether it's current players on my team, that you oftentimes see players just start to blossom after a great summer, because summer is when you don't have classes, you don't have tests to worry about. And if you get off to a great start in the summer and do something like qualify for the USAM, or in Blake's case, qualify for a PGA Tour event, that can really bode well for when you get back to school in the fall.
I mean, when I see numbers like this between three tournaments, the Wolfpack Invitational, the Bank of Tennessee Intercollegiate, and then the Grandover Collegiate, he had nine tournament rounds and seven of them were in the 60s. You'd be hard pressed to see a lot of PGA Tour players do that, and college players. That's rare air when you see that. And he did that, and that blows me away.
Yeah, he's talented for sure, and it's exciting that he's still young, that we still have a year and a half left with him, because he's got a lot of golf left to play here at ECU. But he's definitely done a great job. I mean, he's proven that he can consistently shoot in the 60s, and as spring golf is oftentimes a little bit harder because we get weather conditions that are much more difficult than in the nice fall months. He's going to be able to continue to prove that and continue to play some great golf going on into the rest of the spring.
Head coach of the ECU Pirates, Andrew Sapp, is our guest taking Dead Aim. One other name that stands out to me as I look at your roster and results from the fall is Patrick Stevenson, who's been a very solid performer for you.
Oh, definitely. Patrick, speaking of summers, he didn't have a summer. His summer was filled with rehabbing a reconstructed knee from a torn ACL and MCL. So we were kind of wondering how he would react and if he'd be able to play in the fall. And he really busted it with his rehab, with our athletic trainer, Danielle Petty, and really worked hard over the summer just so that he could tee it up. But literally for our first tournament at Duke, that was the first competitive round he played since our conference championship in April the season before. So he had his ups and downs over the fall, but is really coming into his own. He's done some great work with his swing coach over the winter break as well, and feels really confident about his ball striking. And if his ball striking is good, the kid is one of the best putters and chippers I've ever coached. He's in for a world of a season this spring.
Coach, is the parent of a junior golfer, you just said something that panics the hell out of me. How does a golfer tear his ACL and MCL?
Playing pickup basketball with his teammates.
Ah, good. So it can't happen on a golf course.
Yep. Yeah, it's the golf coach's nightmare. Either that or doing it while skiing over winter break. Oh. Those are the two nightmares that we have.
Whew, that makes me feel better. Okay, let's talk about your team and heading into the spring. You took your team to Puerto Rico. I know this is a tournament that you've taken many of your teams, whether at North Carolina or now at ECU over the years. I guess my first question is about, I hate to go back to weather, but how was Puerto Rico? How is their recovery that has been ongoing from the storm 2 years ago?
It seems like the Puerto Rico itself is getting back on its feet. Obviously, the airport was in tremendous shape. They'd done a lot of renovations to that. And since it is an area and an island that really relies on tourism, I think the resorts, from that standpoint, the golf course itself was in the best shape it's ever been. And I've been going down there for 25 years. And the resort at the Wyndham Rio Mar was newly renovated, had a lot of new restaurants and things like that. So everything there was great. Now, that being said, I'm sure there are plenty of areas on the island that still are struggling.
Right.
Because you don't just recover from that after a year. But it seemed to be, from what we saw, in a lot better shape than it was last year.
Did you get the idea that some of the tourism business has started to come back, or did you get the idea that we're the only people who are staying at the hotel right now?
No, that was kind of what was shocking to me, was the hotel was completely booked.
Great.
I had a parent who last minute wanted to come down, and he had to stay 25 minutes away because our hotel was booked. So it was great to see. It was great to see that tourism was thriving in Puerto Rico, and that people were coming back.
Coach, you got to see some of the classiest teams in the nation when you were at Puerto Rico. Georgia, Oklahoma, Clemson, Georgia Tech, just to name a couple that I know are on everybody's list. Who are some teams that you've seen through your travels and tournaments so far this fall that you've gone, wow, guys, this is where we need to aspire to be?
Well, you just named a few of them. But, yeah, I think really with a young team, it's always important to get to play against some of the best teams in the country, like we did there. Now, we came back a little battered and bruised, but it's good to see where those teams are, because that's what we aspire to be doing, is being a top 25 team. And I tell people all the time, if you want to be a top 25 team, you have to be able to play against the other top 25 teams and beat them. So we had the opportunity to beat some. We just didn't quite get the job done. But it's good to see that we're not that far away. In that tournament, we were just three or four balls in the river away from playing much better than we did. But it's good to kind of early get that assessment of where you are, so for the rest of the spring, you can continue to work on those areas that you need to do to improve going through the home stretch of the spring season.
Yeah, I don't care what the sport is. I never had a coach that didn't agree with the following, and that is, you never got any better playing against people you can beat.
Right. Exactly.
Coach Andrew Sapp from East Carolina, head men's golf coach, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk a little bit about what's ahead. And as we head towards the conference tournament, you'll be at Myrtle Beach. I played the Dunes Club last week. It is in tremendous condition. That's going to be a great tournament for you. Irish Creek, and then the Stitch Intercollegiate at Cary, North Carolina. What are you looking to see in these next three tournaments before you head into the conference championship?
Well, actually, our next tournament, we host our home.
Oh, I'm sorry. I totally missed your home tournament. My bad.
That's okay. This Monday and Tuesday at Brook Valley Country Club, we host the ECU Intercollegiate. We'll have 12 teams there, and we're excited to do that. And it's a great opportunity for our players, because everyone will get to play, whether they play in the starting lineup or as an individual. And then from there, we head down to the Dunes Club, which is a great golf course. We've played well there traditionally. So we're looking forward to going back to the Hackler Intercollegiate and the event that Coastal Carolina puts on. And I know our guys from the Charlotte area on our team are excited about going back to Irish Creek. All of our guys have played that, whether it's in high school invitationals or in the North Carolina Open or
regionals. I know it's the site of a regional this year, so yeah.
Yeah, so it's one of those golf courses our players love, and one of our players, Stephen Carroll, is a member out there, so we're excited to go there. I love the golf course. I've been there half a dozen times for tournaments, so it's going to be a fun event to go to. And then, obviously, returning to McGregor Downs near the end of April, right before conference, is a good way to end our regular season, because it's a golf course with similar greens to Innisbrook, it'll be a good test against a good field to help us prepare for our conference championship.
Now, I see Innisbrook Resort for the American Championship, the American Athletic Conference Championship Tournament. I see Innisbrook, and I start to get scared. They're scary courses at the Innisbrook Resort. Which one do you guys play?
We play the Copperhead.
Ah!
So it's not long after the Valspar. It's only a few weeks after the Valspar is finished, so you can still see some remnants of the grandstands and everything like that. But it's really exciting for our guys because they always pay close attention to the PGA Tour, but the week of the Valspar, they're watching it very closely to see if they can get some tips from players like Tiger and how they play the golf course, getting ready to go down a month later when we play it.
Yeah, see, that's the difference. Your guys can watch them and see how they play it and actually play it like they play it. I look for how they play it, and it just doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference, honestly. Coach, get you out of here with this. Heading into the conference championship, and I'm sure you've gotten to see a lot of the guys in your conference, other teams. Where do you feel like you are at this point, comparatively speaking, to the other teams in your conference?
We've got a strong conference. SMU is the top of the heap. They're ranked in the top 10 right now. We're probably in the 4 or 5 slot, I would think, and there are a bunch of us right around that area. You've got South Florida's probably in the 2nd spot. They're defending champions, and obviously playing in their backyard is good for them. And Central Florida playing not too far away in Tampa. It's a good spot for them as well. But after that, it'll be a dogfight. I mean, we've got some teams that maybe you don't expect to be as good as they are. And in a Cincinnati, who's had a very nice fall and has an excellent number one man who's done a great job for them this season so far. So it will be a little bit of a battle down there to see who comes out on top. So it's going to be a good challenge and a lot of fun as we prepare for it.
Strictly medal play, or is there some match play involved with your tournament?
This year it's strictly medal play. No match play in our conference championship as of yet. It might be coming in the near future, though.
One of my favorite people in the game, East Carolina head men's golf coach Andrew Sapp. And up next, meet Michelle Holmes, a master kids instructor, as she takes dead aim at junior golf. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Hey, we are taking dead aim. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Now we've got something and someone new today. Master Kids instructor Michelle Holmes. So I first met, and I guess that's a weird word because as we're talking, this is really the first time we've spoken, but I first became aware of Michelle a few weeks ago when you posted, I just thought it was the most captivating junior golf photo I had ever seen. It was a little boy and a little girl. Michelle, they couldn't have been, what, 6 years old?
I think you're actually talking about my little niece and nephew who are 4 and 3.
They were just the most precious two kids I've ever seen with their golf bags slung on their shoulders. And it's a view of them walking either from the course or to the course. I don't care. It was just an amazing photograph, and it totally inspired me to do better things for junior golf and leave this game better than I found it. Master Kids instructor Michelle Holmes from Chesapeake, Virginia, is our guest taking dead aim. First off, I got to find out about all sorts of stuff about you. What is your background in the game?
Okay, so you can probably hear the accent. So I'm not from America, and I grew up playing golf in Ireland. And I came to play college golf in America when I was 18, and I played 4 years at Campbell University in North Carolina.
Know exactly where you are.
Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated from Campbell, I went through the LPGA teaching program and gave a shot at opening a kids' golf school. And 10 years later, it's still going strong, and hopefully it'll go for another 20 years.
Michelle is in Chesapeake, Virginia, and she's listed as a master kids instructor. What made you, or what was your mindset in getting into teaching? And it's not just juniors, you're teaching little kids.
Yeah, we teach them as young as 2 and 3 years old.
Oh, my gosh!
Yeah, and we have a lot of good 2 and 3 year old golfers who can bomb a ball out there. So you know, with U.S. kids golf now, with the equipment that's there for kids, you know, like that equipment you saw in that picture, I mean, there's, you know, you can get kids going at 2 and 3 now. They have the lightweight equipment, and they have the training grips on them, so we're creating some really good golf swings.
How many Master Kids instructors are there across the country? Because you're the first one I'd ever heard of.
I think there's maybe, there's about 110 Master Kids teachers worldwide, so it's actually a world thing. I think there's about 110, 120 of them. And I think that's been going for maybe the last 10 years. Yeah, it was a big honor, and yeah, it was a huge achievement, and yeah, I was honored.
So it's a separate program when you go to study?
Yes, yes. So I did my first schooling through the LPGA, and then I became a U.S. Kids certified coach then as well. U.S. Kids really taught me about teaching kids through teaching kids through games. So you know, LPGA was kind of a broad aspect of teaching, whereas U.S. Kids really focused on the little kids.
Michelle Holmes is a Master Kids instructor in Chesapeake, Virginia. She's our guest taking Dead Aim. Some of the questions I get asked a lot is, how young is old enough for my child to be introduced to the game of golf? And I guess you've already answered this with kids as young as 2?
Yeah, as soon as they want to put a club in their hand, let them have it. You know, I get that question a lot, and I always tell parents of, you know, 1 and 2 year olds, the first thing you need to do is just put a plastic club in their hand, throw a plastic ball down there, and let them follow that ball, you know, around the house or the backyard or whatnot. It's all about hand-eye coordination when they're 1 and 2. And then with products from U.S. Kids Golf, I mean, I just bought my nephew who is, well, he's 2 actually. I said 3 earlier, but he's actually 2. I just bought him a club, and it's designed for kids from 33 to 36 inches. So it's the perfect height for him.
Oh, that is just fantastic. Now, Michelle, at what point do you start, I can't think of a better word, properly instructing? In other words, when do you start putting their hands on the club in a proper grip? Or do you just, when they're that young, do you just say, hey, grab it and just do whatever you want?
Yeah, and I'm actually going through that with my nephew right now. He loves to grip left hand low. And, you know, I am tempted to kind of change it, but I let him do his thing. And he gets more power out of it that way. So, no, we really don't push anything until they're maybe 6, 7 years old. But there's still plenty you can teach them at a young age, you know, through games and different stuff like that.
Now, when do you transition from, you know, the games and just horsing around to starting to work on actual things or starting to play, you know, mini versions of a golf hole or whatnot?
Well, we have kids that compete in 9-hole local tour events as young as 5 and 6. So, again, it really depends on the child. You know, you look at the U.S. Kids World Championships, you've got hundreds of kids down there that are 6, 7 years old competing and shooting around level par at age-appropriate tee markers, of course.
Right.
These kids can get it from A to B, you know, quite young these days.
What was the difference in the environment you grew up in, growing up in Ireland, as opposed to what we're seeing today? Were opportunities more plentiful for you, instruction better for you, or is it better over here now?
It's interesting, like when I've talked to a lot of people about this, when I grew up in Ireland, and I'm guessing it was the same thing in America at that point, you know, 20 years ago, the only kids that were playing golf were kids that were really good at the game. So the club I was a member at, they were absolutely wonderful to me. They were really welcoming, but we only had 4 junior girl members, and the 4 of us happened to play on the national junior team. So we were welcomed in the door with open arms, of course. But nowadays, we're seeing much more kids playing for extracurricular activities or just for a social thing or just to use for, you know, future career moves or whatnot. So it's not all just about, you know, the best golfers now. We're seeing a lot more, you know, kids just playing the game for enjoyment or for future uses.
Michelle Holmes is a Master Kids instructor out of Chesapeake, Virginia. She's our guest taking Dead Aim. I think what she does is fascinating. Another thing that I have witnessed firsthand, being the parent of a junior golfer, and I guess he started playing tournament golf around 11, maybe 10 or 11, and he's now a junior in high school. So I've seen a lot, and a lot of what I've seen recently, especially on the upper high school level, is really sickening when it comes to parents. How big a problem is that, and how early have you seen it start?
It's a huge problem. I mean, there's no point in denying it. I wish it wasn't a problem. I wish I didn't have to talk about it all the time. But
well, I think we have to talk about it because it's not going to go away if we don't.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, one of the things I always say, you know, how your child plays at 9 years old has no bearing on their future, but how you react to their play has every bearing. And, you know, especially when we're dealing with young kids, 5 and 6 years old, you know, you are their mental game on the golf course. You know, they haven't developed a mental game yet. So whatever dad or mom is going through mentally, that's going to become the child's mental game. So, you know, the biggest concern for me is, one, the child might fall out of love for the game. Of course they are, if mom or dad are yelling at them all the time. But the things that we need to become a good golfer, like confidence, composure, those kind of things, if your child is turning around and seeing you freak out every time they hit a bad shot, what do you think they're going to learn how to do?
Well, that leads to an interesting question that I have, which is, at what age do individual expectations develop? I mean, let's take parents out of the equation, but just someone who, like your nephew, is 3 years old. He doesn't understand expectations. He doesn't have the concept of what that is.
Right.
And if left alone, at what point does he start to develop those expectations?
Well, as I always say, the greatest thing with little kids is when they fail at something, they just get up and try again. It's no big deal, right? And I always tell adults, let's leave them that way as long as we possibly can. I would say, as far as expectations, I would say probably for girls, I think girls start younger. So I think girls, it's probably about 8 or 9, boys a little bit older. And when I say expectations, I mean, as well as I'm talking about taking ownership of their own game, too.
See, that's what I think the problem comes into play with parents. I think parents push their expectations onto their children way too young. And they, first off, they should be pushing their expectations, period. But I see so many kids who are now 15 and 16 that are battle-scarred from things I remember seeing with these same kids when they were 10 and 11 years old, and it's heartbreaking.
It is, and you know, as I always say, you know, even if you get your child to, you know, play college golf, and then they get to try it on the tour, and not many people do get that opportunity. But let's say you do get your child to that level, well, your child, for your child to want to practice 12 hours a day, like professional golfers do, they still got to love the game as adults. There's still got to be a dying passion in there to want to go out and practice 12 hours a day. So if your kid has been playing golf since 6 years old, and you've been lecturing them since they were 6, you know, I can't imagine how that passion is still going to be there, you know, even if you do get them to that point.
Have you had the experience of having a child that you've been working with, you know, when they were little, and you've seen their parents just get way too involved, and it's actually chased them from the game, and the child actually had potential?
Yeah, I'm very honest with my parents, and they know I'm in this for the kids, so I have no problem telling the parents how I feel. So I would like to say that, no, I haven't seen it with my own students, but I do remember a ton of that growing up in the game, you know, my friends growing up in the game.
Oh, Michelle Holmes is a master kids instructor in Chesapeake, Virginia. She's our guest taking Dead Aim. With your instruction process, and you mentioned that you've got, you know, 5 and 6 year olds that are already transitioning into the U.S. Kids program. At what point do you encourage play outside of U.S. Kids? Because it just seems to me, in the last 5 years as a parent, I've been overwhelmed by the number of different golf associations and tournament opportunities that are out there that I had no idea about.
Well, there's a ton out there. I mean, I'm a huge advocate of U.S. kids. But, you know, you look at have you heard of PGA Junior League? Have you seen what they're doing?
My son was on the very first team that our club had the very first year they did it. And you know what I love most about that program? And I'm glad that you brought that up. What I loved about that program was, at the time, gosh, I want to say he was maybe fifth or sixth grade. And he had always been the little kid that was tagging along with the bigger kids playing golf on the course and at the clubs and whatnot. But for the first time, he got to be the big kid.
Oh,
and the experience of teaming up with kids that were younger than he was and them looking up to him and looking up at his friends that were his age, I thought was an invaluable experience in leadership that I did not expect to come from that.
Oh, it's fantastic. And especially the fact that there's no caddies out there. And even the coaches aren't allowed coach during the play of the hole. So the kids really are doing everything for themselves. The little kids are learning from the older kids, and the older kids, like your son, are getting that, you know, that valuable leadership experience and, you know, that confidence that goes with that. I can't say enough good things about PGA Junior League. The other program I can't say enough about, and we have quite a big program, is the LPGA Girls Golf. Are you familiar with that?
Tell me all about it.
So I love this program because, you know, girls are all about the social side.
No, really?
That's how I get them into this game, make them fall in love with it, and then we worry about creating good golfers. But, you know, there's LPGA programs all over the country, just like there is PGA Junior League. But the way LPGA is focused is, that, like, the way we do our program, when the girls come in, we do maybe 1 hour of golf, and then we do 1 hour social. So the 1 hour of golf may be something like girls golf on the run, and the girls are all divided into teams and they have to race to complete a series of golf challenges. So it's not just going out playing nine holes or whatnot. So it's more interactive. The girls love it, and then they especially love getting to come in and do their movie night or their pizza night or whatever we've got going on, craft night. And I've just seen a lot of girls fall in love with the game through that, and I've seen a lot of girls come into our program who just kind of were doing as a extracurricular activity. And now they're quite, you know, they've grown into competitive golfers who are playing high school golf or thinking about college golf. So it's been fun to kind of watch that side of it.
Michelle Holmes is a master kids instructor in Chesapeake, Virginia, our guest taking Dead Aim. I think the greatest advancement in junior golf that I've seen in, say, the last 5 to 6 years is the inclusion and opportunities for the girls game. I've talked to more than one Symetra Tour player and LPGA Tour player that says, gosh, I wish I'd have had all the things available to me that are available now. Do you agree with that?
Oh, totally. You know, as I said earlier in the conversation, when I was growing up, we had 4 girl golfers, but they were all good girl golfers. I remember once asking my dad, could my cousin come along to play golf? He was horrified that I even asked that question. You know, whereas now, we do so many days where it's like, yeah, bring your friend along or whatnot. So there's so many opportunities for girls to get into golf now. It doesn't always have to be about being the best golfer. And there's so many other reasons to play this game.
Up to a certain age, I'm sure you can work with both boys and girls at the same time. Or do you encourage that?
Boys and girls working together. We probably notice that, you know, up until maybe 11 years old, they don't really pay any attention.
Right.
But after 11, especially if they're new to the game, we try and separate it. And probably even more so equally for the boy and the girl. You know, if you're new to the game and you're in a group of boys, maybe you're kind of feeling a little self-conscious, and vice versa, you know, hitting balls in front of girls if you're new to the game. So we try and separate it maybe at age 12 and above. But before that, it's probably not in effect at all.
Group instruction versus individual instruction. At what point do you recommend working individually as opposed to working with 5 or 6 at a time?
In our program, we encourage both. And most of our kids are probably doing one private lesson a week and maybe 1 to 2 group sessions a week. Boys don't tend to need the group sessions for as long as girls do. But again, I try and keep the girls group sessions going through the high school years. They love that social interaction, whereas the boys don't tend to need that through the teenage years.
Get you out of here on this. Michelle Holmes, Master Kids Instructor, Chesapeake, Virginia, our guest taking Dead Aim. Where can a parent go to look online or whatever to find a Master Kids Instructor nearby?
Yeah, it's quite easy. Actually, if you go to the U.S. Kids website, which is www.uskidsgolf.com, you'll see a section called Coaches. If you click in there, it'll ask for your zip code, and all our U.S. Kids Certified and Master Coaches will come up in your area. So it's very easy.
You could listen to her all day, right? Master Kids Instructor Michelle Holmes. I'd also like to thank East Carolina University Head Men's Golf Coach Andrew Sapp and our friend Ron Green Jr. from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Currently featured there, articles on your golf personality type and matching the right putter to your putter stroke. You could be using the wrong flat stick. Hey, weather-wise, geez, how many times? Looks like another sloppy go at it at best this weekend. But hey, if somehow you find a way to put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.